Good morning. It is 7:46 here on the Mighty 690, and we have our Green Side Up program for you today. We have crop agent James Cooper here with us in studio. Good morning, James. How's it going?
Hey, good morning. Doing good.
Good deal. So we have had kind of, I feel like, I'll be picking your brain here, the weather pattern we have seems like this is what we might expect maybe just a little bit later in the year, or do you think this is more typical?
Well, yes. I mean, we're definitely 2 weeks ahead of schedule, pretty much, you know, weather-wise, all that. So far, I mean, you know, I never want to push away a rain in June, right? I mean, this has been a pretty decent time period of water, I mean, for what we normally get. But yeah, it has undoubtedly been warmer. I mean, we could see that in the growing degree days is what a farmer used to determine how fast their corn is growing and their wheat and, you know, what period it's going to happen what. But it's looking at that, we're way ahead of schedule when it comes to growing degree days. As you can see it on the corn, it's almost already tasseling. That's early, right? So, I mean, it should not be tasseling already. So, but I don't think it's going to be a bad thing, really. The fact that our corn is a little bit shorter than normal, it doesn't really affect the yield as long as there's water when the grain is filling. So,
what about winter wheat? Has anyone started harvesting?
I've noticed some farmers doing a couple little test strips here and there, just testing the water, see what the moisture percentage is. But I don't think the full harvest is rolling yet. I will say farther west, though, it's actually already getting going where it's a little bit drier. They got rained out, too. But I do not expect it to be very long at all.
Yeah, I saw just a little bit, but I mean, it was probably just some tests, but I was just like, wow, yeah. I'm just not expecting that.
I know, yeah. I mean, you know, I know it's supposed to rain here this weekend, but as soon as it dries out, I expect harvest to be in full swing, and soybeans are going in right behind it.
So. Sure. It'll be getting busy here. Yeah. So today, I know, speaking of beans, that you wanted to talk a little bit about bean inoculation.
Yeah, so kind of even more important with double crop beans is to talk about soybean inoculation. And so by inoculation, I mean the symbiotic rhizobium that's on the soybean roots. And so it's, you know, the little bacteria that lives inside the roots, and it provides nitrogen to the soybean. What it's actually doing is it's sucking into out of the air and converting that with the sugar in the plant and some other compounds and turning that into some sort of nitrates. It's actually an incredibly difficult and complicated chemical process. So the fact that little bacteria can do it is really kind of remarkable, honestly. There's not a whole lot of else that can, I mean, it takes humans an incredible quantity of energy, and we have never been able to figure out how bacteria do it in the way they do. So it happens on pretty any legume crop, so garden beans, soybeans, really even some types of trees like locusts, all the legumes, there's a little bacteria on the roots. And you can buy little packages of inoculation mix and mix it with your green beans or anything like that. Then that is all possible to get them on there. A lot of the time you buy green bean seeds and they don't have the inoculant on it. And farmers, they do the same thing, but on a way bigger scale. So if you buy a bag of soybeans, a lot of the time, depending on where they came from, they will already be inoculated. And so they'll have the inoculation on the seed along with some other compounds, you know, insecticide and such. A lot of the time, though, they don't. And so you can buy those, like, it's just a bag of black powder, honestly. And then you just dump it into your seeder box and you mix it all together by hand. And that's kind of what you get. It's a little bit harder to do some of the farmers because they have great big air seeders, right? You could still do the same thing. You just pour it into the bare air seeder box as you're filling it up. So it's a lot of the same, honestly. But the rhizobia, they can survive from year to year in the soil. So if it's a soybean field that's had soybeans in it not very long, I mean, just literally last year, you're probably safe not to worry about rhizobia. But there are a lot of conditions where, you know, you might want to not take that guarantee. I mean, adding that inoculum is not very expensive, and it really is a safe bet. I mean, adding more isn't going to hurt anything for sure.
Sure. So I know that you know, poor soil conditions can be a problem. And what are we talking about when it comes to poor soil conditions?
Yes. So there's a lot of things that can affect a soybean's ability to feed those rhizobia. And if it doesn't feed the rhizobia, basically rhizobia don't survive on there. And so it can create a condition where everything was set up. The rhizobia was there, but the soybeans didn't allow the rhizobia to infect it, pretty much. And that's what it is. It's actual infection. It sends out those little fungal hyphae, even though it's bacteria, into the roots and grabs a hold of it. But it's actually the plant that allows that to happen. So soils that are too acidic, basically below 6 pH, sometimes that toxicity, the low pH will create a toxicity with the metals, because the metals, they'll have different forms at a low pH, and that can be toxic. Poor absorption of nutrients, and even just generally, the bacteria have a harder time surviving in that environment. And so roots will have issues with iron toxicity. Basically, iron becomes so soluble, so readily available, that plants cannot help but take up iron. They can't stop it from getting into the roots. And that's kind of the same thing with bacteria. They just can't help it. There's just so much soluble iron floating around that nobody can deal with it. And so it ends up creating a toxicity. Usually that happens around 5.5 and below. That's when iron starts to really become real toxic. So soil nitrates that are too high. This is probably the most common one when it comes to soybean inoculation. So the soybeans, they will only take on those rhizobia if they think they need to. But if there's too many nitrates or too much nitrogen in the soil during that specific time point, they won't take them on. Basically around V3 to V6, which some of our early planted beans are there right now, if there's too much nitrogen there, the rhizobia won't be accepted. Even if the soybean needs it later on, the soybean is already past the point when rhizobia is even possible. So it could be nitrogen deficient later on because it had too much nitrogen early in the season. And sometimes that happens with, let's say you have a little bit of a dry winter, there's a little bit too much nitrates in the soil, or some other application beforehand, maybe you put on too much potash or too much DAP, I should say. There's too much nitrogen, and then the soybeans don't take it on, and then you see a nitrogen deficiency. And so that can easily happen, and I don't know, most farmers and agronomists have seen that before. Low phosphorus, and that's more towards the plant not being able to support the rhizobium. It's not really toxicity. And also, of course, the bacteria, they need phosphorus too. Low molybdenum. Molybdenum is a micronutrient that we need in incredibly small quantities. I'm talking like parts per billion. It's the lowest level of micronutrient that we need in the soil of any of the others. But oddly enough, it has a specific elemental, attraction or compound that it creates, and it's absolutely necessary for the bacteria to convert those nitrogen enzymes in to make that stuff happen. And so it's usually not deficient in soils in this area. I would say that there are some other micronutrients like boron that are probably more likely to be deficient that are also important to the process. But molybdenum is specific towards that creation of that nitrogen compound. And so, of course, there are some other environmental stressors like drought and waterlogging, which happens a lot around here. Basically, the soybeans sitting underwater for that entire time period, the bacteria just can't make it in there. And so they're going to die off. High soil temperatures, that has happened in the past too, where we've had that weird June heat wave, or even July, depending on what you get your double crop soybeans in, and it can steam the soil. And so the soil, if you get the rain in the perfect time or whatever, it's a hot rain, and the soil is hot and you have a bare soil, it ends up creating like a layer of steam in the soil. It's not actually like full on steaming, but you could feel it.
Oh yeah.
Really. And bacteria are not very resistant to high temperatures. I mean, you start to get in the 90s, 100s, and that will cook that bacteria.
Sure.
And so, I mean, It's possible. I've seen soybeans that were doing good and then it just got bleached. It's almost like coral bleaching in the ocean.
Yeah.
I mean, they turn white.
So what happens if they die?
If they die, you know, the soybean will show symptoms really quick. They quickly become yellow, chlorotic, nitrogen deficient. Soybeans use an incredible quantity of nitrogen. So if they don't have it, I mean, they do get yellow real fast. And, you know, technically you could fertilize soybeans with nitrogen. They usually don't yield any better than nodulated soybeans. And, of course, it's very expensive. So we want to prevent that from happening pretty much every time. Most of the time I've seen soybeans that were not inoculated well, you just end up with short little yellow soybeans. There's not really a whole lot you can do about it, honestly. They do yield by pulling out whatever nitrogen they can possibly find out of the soil, but they sure won't make the yield that you want.
So what did the nodules look like?
So these little nodules, they're kind of weird, actually. They look like an infection, and they kind of are. They're an infection, like an insect gall on the root. And so a healthy one, if you pull up your soybean carefully, because you can pull the nodules off and you pull it out. And so if you pull up your soybean, you probably need to wait till about V6, V7 if you're really going to see something. Basically, seven little trifoliates on some branching, basically, on the soybean. You pull them out, and you pop one of these little nodules, and they should be pink on the inside. The pink is from the lake hemoglobin, and that's what's creating that. Basically, you know how our blood has hemoglobin, and that's why it's red. It's kind of not the same chemical, but it's the same idea. The hemoglobin for legumes. And so the dead ones, they'll be gray and mushy. And so pink is good, gray is bad. When checking for soybeans, you know, you got to wait until you really see something. If you check them now, it's going to be too early. I mean, you're not going to see them at V2. It's too young. So, you know, make sure that they're there if you're kind of wondering about inoculation. But as for your double crop soybeans, if your field hasn't had soybeans in the last year, go ahead and just put some inoculation in with them. It's not all that expensive for that guarantee.
Very good.
Honestly.
So some good advice. We'll talk more with James Cooper, crop agent for K-State Extension Wildcat District, coming up next. Back here on the Mighty 690, we have crop agent James Coover with us here in studio. And as we continue right along, first of all, James, are there any other events that are going on within the Wildcat District that you'd like to bring to our attention here this morning?
Oh, nothing in the crop-wise anyways. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, they got plant-to-plate going on right now. Oh, they've got a few other camps, and I guess I'm not connected well enough into the whole camp season, but it's definitely, we're right in the middle of 4-H camps and other things, and so, and fair's not far away too, so there is a little plenty of stuff going on.
That's right, we got those fairs kicking off about a month from now, so we'll be looking forward to it here. But I know today you wanted to talk, is there anything else you wanted to wrap up on the topic of bean inoculation?
No, not really. I mean, it's just one of those things. I just want farmers to be prepared, because every year I end up seeing a field that just wasn't inoculated, and you know, the soybeans aren't doing very well. And sure, it's kind of a cheaper thing to fix now because you can't fix it later. So just make sure that your beans are inoculated if you haven't had soybeans in that field in the last past couple of years. So
absolutely a great reminder on that. So taking a look here at our next topic, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about overdrift. So where do you want to start with that?
Yeah, overdrift, it's not my favorite conversation, to be honest with you. And I will say that because pretty much anybody who calls with an overdrift issue is because they're overdrifted on and they're mad. So, you know, it's not really an educational situation. It's just trying to help people how you can. So, you know, overdrift this time of year is when it really starts to pick up, you know, a little bit before now and into now. And it could be a real problem. And so, you know, part of that is the burn down for the soybean fields. Of course, it can happen pretty much any time from, I'm talking April all the way to July is a good overdrift season. And so soybean fields, of course, we're burning them down. Like, you know, after we harvest, we might burn them down before we plant the soybeans. And so now's another good time. And it's getting hotter out, which kind of helps the overdrift situation. So, you know, a lot of those herbicides, they have a tendency to drift. We're talking about 2,4-D and dicamba. I'd say those are the two main culprits for volatilization drift. And, of course, just regular wind drift, that can happen with pretty much anything. And so, as it gets hotter out, a lot of these herbicides will tend to volatilize. They literally just enter into the atmosphere. This is going to be days, well, not days usually, but after the spray has happened, they've just particulate into the air, and they can move with even the slightest breeze. Often not, if there's no breeze at all, they'll tend to settle down like fog, pretty much. It's sort of like a fog. They can really describe it the best. And so, you know, besides volatilization, we also have direct drift, which is caused by the wind. Most of the time, that's actually what's happening, is you get a garden that's just downwind, usually on the north side or the south side of a field that got sprayed, and during that time frame, it's moving over that garden. And so the biggest risk, of course, is people out in the country, or at least, you know, somewhat in the country, homeowners around ag fields. It, gardeners will be at much more at risk than people just with trees and shrubs. If you don't have a garden, you can probably get some overdrift. It's probably not going to be that big of a deal. But gardens and orchards are really the main issue when it comes to overdrift. It's hard to intentionally kill a tree with herbicides. And so unintentionally killing a tree with herbicides, it's also very difficult. Most of the time, they'll be fine, even if you see symptoms. So really, some plants are way more susceptible than others. Tomatoes, peppers, grapevines, those are the three that you're going to see stuff. Tomatoes, I mean, if they even look at a herbicide, I mean, it can be so far away. if you could smell it in the air, that's enough of an application. And 2,4-D stinks. So you know if there's 2,4-D being sprayed because it smells bad. And that can kind of help you tell, like, well, what are they actually spraying? So, you know, tomatoes, if they get a little bit of 2,4-D, they're going to crinkle up. I mean, pretty much right away. And most gardeners have seen that before, the elongation of the leaf. It looks odd. Now, there are some diseases that can kind of look like that, but you can tell pretty easily what it is. Red bud trees are actually another tree species that is susceptible. Now, it's hard to kill a red bud tree, but they get the cupping of the leaf really easily. And so just a little bit of herbicide. And we're talking about rates of, you know, parts per thousand. I mean, it's way less than a normal rate, and you could still see some damage. So,
sure. So what should a homeowner do if they suspect herbicide overdrift?
So I don't have a lot of good news or good advice when it comes to this. There isn't a lot you can do. First off, don't always assume it was overdrift, because there are some diseases that do look like overdrift, especially this time of year when we're getting like a lot of water and then no water and then a lot of water. You can end up having some physiological effects that looked a little bit drifty. But I know when you start to see that severe elongation, some goosenecking and other things, that's pretty intel signs that it actually was a herbicide. Not everything that farmers are spraying now is a herbicide. So also keep that in mind. Just because a farmer is spraying does not mean that it is a herbicide. Sometimes they're fungicides, insecticides. You know, like not very long ago, we were spraying wheat with planes and drones and such. That was all fungicide. So don't worry about that. That's not going to hurt you. But, you know, at this point, really, we're only kind of doing soybeans. I mean, for the most part, everything else is already done. I mean, corn's already too tall, so we're not going to be spraying that with anything herbicide-wise. So it's mostly the soybean fields that we're worried about herbicide. Now, a light herbicide damage, you can recover from. They're tomatoes and peppers, they look bad for a little while. They'll grow out of a light herbicide damage. But, you know, it takes a little while. It takes a long while, honestly. And so I know that my tomatoes, they were sprayed twice this year from the field. And it was a ways away. I mean, it was like a quarter of a mile away. But I know it was because I could smell it the day that that they were spraying out there. It's like, well, it's too late for me to help them out now. And now they looked bad for a while. and now they're starting to come out of it. My peppers, they got hit worse. I don't know why. Usually peppers are more resistant, but they looked real bad, and they still kind of look pretty bad, honestly.
Obviously, if you got a big garden, it'd be tough, but is there any way you could, like, cover that up a little bit?
Yes, you can. And so if you know that it's going to happen, or if that it's, you know, right before it happens, you can cover them up. Basically, use bed sheets, you know, pillowcases to fit over your peppers. I mean, whatever it is, any kind of physical block, and you can make quite a bit of difference. And I don't know this, this isn't something that I read, it's not an extension approved comment, but whether you can get like some mist in the air or something to capture it, I think that would be a possibility as well. Maybe turn your sprinklers on, but
wouldn't hurt.
You know, I don't think that it could capture those particulates as they're flying around. Really, a physical barrier is going to be best. And also, any kind of wind block. So you have a row of cedar trees or anything, that is actually going to help capture a lot of that stuff, and you're creating a wind dead zone where your garden is. And so the proper placement of trees can actually help quite a bit, honestly, when it comes to reducing that overall damage. But yes, you can cover them up. So, and it's not a perfect solution, but it's sure better than nothing. So, you know, most of the time, though, people don't know that their stuff got sprayed until it was already too late. I mean, you know, the sprayer has already left the field. The chemical was already over the place. You know, they come outside and they smell the 2,4-D. Well, I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do. If it was already hours ago, your stuff got sprayed. And, you know, there's not really a good way of rinsing your plants off. I mean, that 2,4-D, as soon as it gets on there, it absorbs fairly quickly. So if it just happened, you might be able to do something, but really for the most part, it's pretty fast. So what can you do after the fact? I mean, first off, know that it is a risk of living out in the country. It's just kind of happens, honestly. I mean, you know, herbicide applications, they do have a lot of rules. That's true. I mean, you have to spray at a certain time. You have to catalog a lot of what you spray. I mean, there's certain wind speeds and other things, especially when it comes to dicamba. That is a nightmare, honestly, of trying to get dicamba onto some dicamba-resistant soybeans. You know, there's just so many rules. But that stuff still happens. I mean, it takes almost no wind at all to carry 2,4-D and dicamba in a direction that you don't want it to go to. You never know when the wind's going to shift. And so it's easy to get drifted on out in the country. It just is. And so the farmer or the co-op, they might not have done anything off the label. They might not have done anything wrong, and it still just kind of happened. I mean, they were following the label. They were following the rules, and, you know, your garden was just kind of in the way, to be honest. And so, yeah, it's just part of living out there.
Yep, sure.
I hate to say it. Sure. And, you know, I mean, I'm not happy that my garden has been sprayed pretty much every year for years now, but I also understand sometimes it just happens. I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, it was actually our own pasture that was sprayed. Right. I mean, I was the one that caused it. And I thought that I was following all the rules. The wind was going the other direction. But, you know, something happened, and it just happened.
Now, so, and obviously, you know, with our crops, you know, the reason that we can spray a lot of these is, you know, there's like the Roundup Ready crops and everything like that. But there's no such thing really for garden plants, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are Roundup Ready corn, but it's not really the Roundup. I mean, that's glyphosate, right? That's easy. But yeah, there's no 2,4-D and dicamba resistant tomatoes.
No one's gonna bother with that.
Yeah. I mean, technically that would be a possibility for some future thing, but
be a good research project. For some K-State student out there.
Yeah, that's a whole level of genetic inoculation. Yeah, it takes a long time.
Because that's how they actually made those initially. You know, they were able to, you know, genetically isolate.
Yes, yeah. And so a lot of that GMO stuff, and we do have some GMO sweet corn, but for the most part, there's not a whole lot of GMOs when it comes to those things. And I mean, you know, non-dicamba resistant, like non-dicamba soybeans, not Xtend or Cinemax or whatever, they are incredibly susceptible to dicamba. And so a lot of the time, the drifts calls I get called on are actually to soybean fields, because it's a rate of 1 to 10,000, and you can see like 10,000 times less than a normal application, and you can see damage. you can actually see damage at 100 thousandths of a rate. Can you imagine, like, we're talking about parts per billion, and you could still see some damage. Most of the time, they'll recover. I mean, you have to get a higher rate for them to actually get hurt. But it sure don't take a lot to take down a soybean, so it sure don't take a lot to take down a tomato either. And, you know, if you really think that a herbicide has truly been misused, and I have been on a call where I was like, there is no possible way that was used correctly, you know, I've seen it before. I mean, you can fill out a KDA pesticide complaint form. Now, this is an official government form, so if you fill one out, they have to respond. It's required. They are required to respond, and they, of course, they are inundated this time of year with requests. So keep that in mind. They sometimes will take a few weeks. You need to put down your name, your number, all that. They'll call you. You know, they want you to take pictures of the damage when that happened, you know, beforehand. So going that route is possible. I mean, if you're mad enough, you want to contact the KDA, that can happen. But I will say, though, you know, keep in mind the KDA, they might look at the damage. Often not, they don't actually come out. They will look into spray logs and timings. You know, but the KDA, they only monitor whether a pesticide was used correctly. They only monitor the licensing. They don't actually have any sort of function of economic recalibration, right? They don't actually do anything beyond look at that. And so there's no punishable effect, honestly, beyond the license itself. If there's any sort of compensation, that's a civil court issue. There's no court system to make somebody follow the rules. And so keep that in mind, is that, you know, the KDA has their rules. Extension, I mean, all we do is educate. I mean, there's no regulational enforcement to make people not spray on your garden, honestly. As long as they're following the label, I mean, everything's being followed.
Sure. So that's by the main reminder for folks who are spraying is just, you know, follow, like what, yes, I was saying, follow,
yeah,
the label.
Yeah. And for the most part, I know that they do. I mean, for the most part, I know they follow the label. But I actually have also seen cases where they probably weren't following the label so much. I mean, I would like spray guys to keep in mind is that there are a lot of gardens out there. People have put a lot, and I know that they have a lot of work to do because, you know, we have rain here, and then dry, and then rain, then dry. And so during that two-day period, when the wind is gentle enough and the ground is dry enough, they got to get out there and get stuff done. I mean, that window that they can apply herbicides is so short that they've got to roll. But, you know, it's always good to keep an eye out. It's like, oh, well, you know, what are the various vectors? Where can this go to? So, you know, it's part of diligence from everyone involved. But if you are a gardener out there, you know, you have a lot of plants you don't want sprayed on, know who your neighbors are, know who those farmers are, and know what co-op they're going to use. I mean, it is possible just to get a phone call like, hey, we're going to be, I've got myself on the list. They're probably going to be out tomorrow to spray your my soybean field. And so you need to be prepared with the sheets and the pillowcases and all that, and get your stuff covered as well as you can. Some things just aren't easy to cover, and do the best you can. Hopefully the wind's going the other direction, and now just do your due diligence of knowing your neighbors and doing that. And we can kind of just help each other, honestly.
Yeah.
Is the best thing I can say.
Little communication can go a long way.
That's right.
All right. Well, James, if folks do have questions for you, they want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do that?
So having issues, just give me a call in the Wildcat Extension offices. The number for Gerard is 620-724-8233.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. And thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yep. Thank you.
That is Crop Agent James Coover here on the Mighty 690. And coming up, we do have our Farm to Fork program, Words of Inspiration. We'll be getting into open line here in just a few minutes.